Lot and Toffley gate were reversible classical gates, right? So Knot, of course, takes A to, you can write it as A plus 1. C Knot takes AB to A plus B. And Toffley ABC to ABC plus AB. And other gates I showed you were more quantum gates, like the Hadamard gate. And Hadamard, I guess you can say, takes A to 0 plus minus 1 to the A 1, right? It's 0 goes to 0 plus 1, and 1 goes to 0 minus 1. And there was an R theta gate, which takes A to E to the minus 1 to the A I theta A. It's a phase gate. Okay, phase rotation gate. I think those were all the gates I mentioned explicitly yesterday, but of course we discussed a little bit how to build more complicated gates by putting together these gates. And so that's the first topic I want to talk about today. Most generally, we want to be able to do, we want a quantum computer to be able to do, do any unitary any unitary on n qubits, right? So that's in general, that's u of 2 to the n. Actually, maybe we don't really care about u 2 to the n, because this, there's a, remember, there's a global phase that has no physical significance. So we'll be happy with su 2 to the n. But that's still a lot of gates. And what we'd like to be able to do is start with some smaller set of gates. We don't want to have to, every time we want to do a new unitary, we don't have to want to make it up out of from scratch. Right? We want to start with some relatively small set of relatively nice gates and put them together to get any unitary. Okay? And so that's the notion of a universal set of gates. So, of course, when we put together a bunch of unitary transformations, we do one after the other. If you write them as matrices, the result of doing a series of them is the product of those matrices. So we want to be able to write this arbitrary unitary as a product of gates from the universal set. And that's basically one of the definitions of a universal set of gates. It turns out there's actually a little more subtlety to this, which I'll get to in a minute. But for now, let's just take it at face value. So we want in general, to say, here's some arbitrary gate. So classically, it would be an arbitrary function of n bits. Quantumly, it was arbitrary unitary on n qubits. And we'd like to build it up out of gates from some universal set. And so we'd like to know what universal sets are. So so we discussed this a little bit already yesterday with respect to classical irreversible gates. But let me just repeat that. So classically, we want to compute an arbitrary function of n bits. And if we have irreversible classical computation, I mentioned that a universal set of gates is not an AND. Okay? And again, this corresponds, roughly speaking, to addition, in this case only adding one, and multiplication in binary arithmetic. And that allows you to put those together to get any function. So maybe one word of how we usually consider this. So usually when I write a set like this, I mean we can do not on any single bit anywhere in the function, or in the computation of the function, in the circuit, anywhere in the circuit, and on any pair of bits. Okay. Now, if you want, you can consider gate sets which don't have this property, that you can do them between. For instance, you might say, well, the bits are arranged on a line, and I can only do the AND between bits that are next to each other, for instance. Or you might say that, you know, between bits 1 and 2, I can do the AND. Between 2 and 3, I can do the OR. And then it gets, of course, arbitrarily complicated, because you can look at the different subsets and consider different sets of gates. But usually, we'll just restrict to this situation where you can do it between any pair. In practice, it's not always a good assumption. Like I said, I didn't say this, but later this week, when we start to talk about implementations, in some of these implementations, it's very hard to do gates between qubits that are very far apart, right? And actually, you want to do them close together. Classically, it's relatively easy to build a wire that connects the two. But quantum mechanically, I mean, there are ideas for how to do that, but it depends on the implementation, whether that's an easy thing or a hard thing to do. So at some level, the features of the physical system that you're using to build this quantum computer come into it. But at this level, we're just talking theoretically, and it's all the theory is kind of simpler if you don't worry about that complication. Okay, so we'll just say that if we can do a gate, we can do it on any subset of qubits of the right size. Okay, so back to classical universal sets of gates. So this is for irreversible computation, and of course there's other universal sets you could write down. So for instance, an easy variation would be not and or instead of and. And using De Morgan's rule, you can switch between and or when you have not available. Okay, but let's move on to reversible sets of gates. So judging by this, you can perhaps easily imagine that since the reversible version of and is the Toffoli gate, right, which keeps track of both the inputs and then computes the AND and the third bit, that NOT and Toffoli gate is a universal reversible set of gates. And that's true. But it turns out that actually you don't even need the NOT gate. And the reason for that is quite simple, which is that the Toffoli gate itself can do a NOT. Right? And the reason is, if you let A and B both be 1, then C goes to C plus 1. Okay? So this kind of extra bit that we added gives the Toffoli the capability to act. It acts as an AND. If you start with C as 0, then it calculates the AND of A and B. But if you start with A and B as 1 and C is your input, then it just calculates the NOT of C. Okay? So in order to make this work, of course, we need the ability to create 0 and 1 ancilla bits as input, right, in order to make Toffoli function as either the NOT or the AND. Okay? So it turns out that if you want a universal set of reversible gates, you actually need to go to 3-bit gates like Toffoli, whereas for the irreversible classical gates, you could make do with just 2-bit. So that's one sense in which reversible seems a little more complicated than irreversible. Okay, so now let's move on to a quantum case. So quantum case, it seems like in principle it could be much more complicated, right? Because not only do we have to do all a reversible classical computation, but we have to do lots of extra rotations, right, that involve superpositions with the Hadamard and the phase gates and, you know, arbitrary 2 to the n by 2 to the n unitary matrices. But it turns out there's actually still very simple universal sets of gates. So one of the best known ones is this, C naught plus arbitrary single qubit unitaries. So that's basically it's U2. Okay? And again, these single qubit unitaries could act on any single qubit in the computation. The C naught can act on any pair of qubits. So this is nice. So this is actually saying that that for quantum, we can go back to two qubit gates and be universal. And note that this means that the Toffoli gate can be built out of these things. Okay. So classically, if you're stuck with classical reversible computation, the Toffoli gate cannot be built out of C naught and single bit gates. But it can be built out of C naught and single qubit gates. Okay? So by doing something quantum, by changing the basis, you can actually create a classical function that you could not have created from this simple set. Yeah?
So we are just using the non-commutativity of
the
matrices.
Yes, so the non-commutativity is very important. But remember that even classically, these gates don't commute. Right, because you still have to write them as matrices, right? They're not diagonal matrices. You remember we wrote down like the C naught and the Toffoli gate. And it's not too hard to come up with a simple classical circuit where you can see that changing the order of the gates matters a lot. But yes, in fact the non-commutivity is also very important in this kind of construction. But the main thing is that we need to use superposition. That's the thing that we don't have classically. Okay. Are there other questions so far? Okay. So one thing that's a little bit remarkable about this set of gates is that despite the fact that you're only doing these 1 and 2 qubit gates, you can actually get exactly any unitary transformation. But that's actually a little too strong when we ask that universal sets of gates could get exactly any unitary. Because if you can get really, really close to the unitary you want, that's usually good enough. Okay? And if you can get arbitrarily close, that's definitely good enough. So in fact, there's some universal sets of gates that don't get to exactly arbitrary unitaries, but get arbitrarily close. And so here's two examples of those. So in this one, we're back to using the Toffoli gate. And we don't really need the C naught because it can be derived from the Toffoli gate. So I guess I could have removed that from here. We also have the Hadamard and pi over 4 phase rotation. Okay, and putting these together, we can certainly get a whole lot of things. And it turns out that this is a universal set of gates in the weaker sense that I'm about to define. And here's a different version that doesn't use the Toffoli gate. It still only uses 1 and 2 qubit gates. It uses the pi over 8 phase rotation instead of the pi over 4 phase rotation. Okay, but otherwise it's similar. So these are universal. But only in a weaker sense. So in particular, yeah. Oh.
Would it be universal in some respect?
I believe so, yes. So I'm fairly sure, but I'd have to check to be absolutely sure, that if you have the Hadamard and phase rotation by an arbitrary angle, r theta, then you can get all of U2. Okay? And so then once you throw in C0, then you have everything. Maybe it's SU2 rather than U2, but that's, again, just a question of the global phase. Anyway. Other questions? Yeah.
If you have a phase rotation that is not a multiple of five, so you have like one radius.
Right.
Can you then kind of space fill the?
Yeah. So in that case, you'll also be universal only in this weaker sense because. You'll be universal only in this weaker sense, but. Certainly, if you have like a rotation by an irrational angle, if you can get by taking it to some power, you can get arbitrarily close to rotation by any angle, right? So in particular, you can get arbitrarily close to these. So that's good enough. Okay, so let me define this weaker sense before we get too many other questions. So in particular, products, the set of products of these gates are dense in SU2 to the n. There's some projective funniness going on here. Once you mod out by global phase, they're dense in SU2 to the n. Dense means that for every matrix, and any distance from that any unitary matrix in SU2 to the n, and any distance from that matrix, no matter how small, but non-zero, then there's some product of either of these sets of gates that is at least that close to that matrix. Okay, so in other words, you can approximate any unitary to as much precision as you like using products of things from one of these universal sets. Okay. So there's a variety of nice things about these particular sets, but the one that I want to point out now is that they're finite sets. Okay, and that's a kind of a useful thing for a couple of reasons. For instance, it means that you don't need to, if you have settings on your machine that I have gate 1 and gate 2 and gate 3, a bunch of buttons you want to press, well, you only need a finite number of them as opposed to an infinite number. Now, in practice, in a lot of machines, you can say, well, I'll run it for some arbitrary amount of time, turn on the Hamiltonian for some arbitrary amount of time. And that can give you, in principle, an infinite set of gates. But in practice, it's not really infinite, right? Because you have some precision to how well you can measure time and really how well you can turn on and off this Hamiltonian. And so getting really an arbitrary single-qubit unitary, which could involve irrational numbers in the matrix, transcendental numbers, arbitrarily weird numbers in the angles involved, you can't do that, right? So in practice, restricting to a finite set is a much more reasonable thing to do. And this is actually a very small finite set, so that's convenient too. Restricting to a finite set comes with a price, and this is the price. And how do you know this is the price? Well, if you take the product of any set of matrices from a finite set, take arbitrary long products, well, then you'll get infinitely many possible matrices, but it'll only be a countable cardinality, right? Whereas SU2 to the n, that involves real numbers in its definition, right? So it's an uncountable set. Okay, so you can't possibly get exactly, using a finite set of universal gates, you can't possibly exactly get SU2 to the n, but you can get a dense set, right? Just like the rational numbers are dense in the real numbers, the products of these are dense in this this bigger set of unitaries. Yeah?
This might be completely tangential, but I mean, in practical terms, finding an element of SC2 to the power n in terms of smaller unitaries may be something hard to do.
Yes, that's right. OK, and that was exactly the next point I wanted to make. But before I do that, are there other questions about this idea of a universal set of gates? No? Okay. So then to return to this point. So this is a very important caveat. So just because it's possible to get an arbitrary unitary or to get close to an arbitrary unitary with a set of gates doesn't mean that it's something you can do quickly. Okay? So building a particular unitary from gates from the universal set that might not be an efficient process. And I'm using efficient here in a particular technical sense that computer scientists like to use. But for now, let's just say what this means is that so what it means is that in particular, some unitaries will require exponentially many gates. Okay, so if you're building, you know, if you want to build a unitary that acts on 100 qubits, which is, you know, a lot more than we can do today, but it's not, I mean, it's not that far out, right? It's something we could imagine in you know, 10 years or something, maybe. The problem is that some of the unitaries might take 2^100 gates to build. Okay, and so that's kind of what I was getting at yesterday when I said that a lot of the Hilbert space is not really easily accessible. It turns out that the same kind of argument can show that there's a lot of states that can't be built without using exponentially many gates. Okay, and so in practice, we want to restrict our attention to things that don't require this huge, huge number of gates. Some unitaries are relatively easy to build. They only require a polynomial number of gates. Some are much harder. They require exponentially many. Yeah. No, it holds for any universal set. Well, okay, so any universal set with kind of, bounded size. So this certainly holds for this set, okay? And if you just restrict to, you know, arbitrary 2-qubit gates or arbitrary 3-qubit gates, you have the same problem, okay? Now, if you start out with, if your universal set is all unitaries, then obviously it's not true anymore, okay? But that's cheating. So the point is that by restricting to gates that just act on a few qubits, that's really what we can physically do to start with. And then you have this kind of criterion. People sometimes consider complexity classes that give you a few gates that act on many qubits. And then some of these hard ones become easy, but not all of them. Because if you make them all easy, then it's cheating. OK. So this distinction between the hard gates that require exponentially many gates and the easy gates, which don't, that's the subject of quantum algorithms and quantum complexity. And then, of course, there's a whole classical version of this, classical algorithm and classical complexity. And I'll be talking about some of this next week. OK. So that's one caveat. The other caveat is that just because you have a universal set of gates doesn't mean you can do whatever you want, right? What you can do is still has to be unitary, okay? And that's where the no cloning theorem comes in. As an easy example of something you can't do, right? So the no cloning theorem, you remember, says there is no machine that takes some arbitrary state psi to two copies of psi. Right? And that gets followed by linearity. And so, as we were discussing yesterday, if you think classically, well, we do have a machine that will take 0 to 2 copies of 0 and 1 to 2 copies of 1. Right? In fact, you can do that with just a C-naught gate and an ancilla that starts in the state 0. Whatever this is, you'll get. Okay? But the point is that this doesn't work on superposition. Right? Instead, you extend this by linearity, you get alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, an entangled state. Okay? So that's the thing to bear in mind, is that you can't just say, oh, I want to do this. You have to check that what you want to do is allowed by the laws of quantum mechanics. Okay? But once it is, then you can build it out of the universal set of gates. Okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So then it's classical. So the superposition is kind of the superposition is the linear extension essentially of these two basis states. Okay. So remember the Hilbert space is a linear vector space over the complex numbers. And so these are arbitrary complex numbers, but of course then you have to normalize it. Unitaries are an example of linear maps. Every quantum operation has to be linear. So whatever it does to this and to this, to the basis states, you can extend to arbitrary superpositions. So that's linearity. I should say there's one possible other source of confusion. I was talking about this type of linearity, adding stuff mod 2. So that's something that happens inside the kets. That's just a totally different vector space. You have to distinguish between kind of Z2 linearity, which you can have a classical function that's linear, like C0, and this complex linearity that you get in quantum mechanics. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but. Okay. Are there other questions? Okay. Right. So then let's move on to come up with an example of something you can do with quantum gates. And that's quantum teleportation. Did Ben do this at all in his class?
No.
Okay.
I think it was part of an example in a homework like on those second, but not
Okay. Right, okay. Anyway, I'll do it again, and we can, maybe people didn't get the homework either, so it's another possibility. Okay, so quantum teleportation is a simple quantum protocol, and the idea here is you have two people, Alice and Bob, and Alice would like to send a qubit to Bob. But the problem is she doesn't have any kind of quantum communications channel. All she has is Alice and Bob can communicate classically. That's okay. That's the communication. But they also share a quantum resource, which is an entangled state. So the entangled state is an EPR pair, maximum entangled state, and it's of the form 0, 0 plus 1, 1. And I'm going to label A and B for the different qubit, the two qubits of this entangled state. Of course, qubit A is held by Alice, and qubit B is held by Bob. And she wants to send some qubit, which I'm going to call I for input. Okay? So if they just have a classical channel, then there's no way they can do this, right? Because Bob wants to get exactly the qubit that Alice started with. And Alice, well, if they only had a classical channel, all she could do would be to make some measurement on the qubit and then send the result of her measurement over the communications channel. But, of course, the measurement is not going to capture everything about the qubit, right? She can't make a perfect measurement that completely identifies the qubit. And, therefore, some information would get lost in that process. But with the entangled state, it turns out, she can actually completely accurately send the qubit, even though she only has this classical communications channel. And what's more, she only has to send a finite amount of information. She has to send two classical bits. So how does that work? Well, so here's a circuit. So here's the I bit. I'll draw here the EPR pair. This is A and this is B. And so these two bits up here are held by Alice. And this one down here is held by Bob. Some people over there may not be able to see Bob, but he's there. Okay, and so Alice's input qubit we'll call psi. And so this is going to be time zero. And then once we get started, first thing that Alice is going to do is she's going to interact her qubit with the A qubit from the EPR pair. And in particular, she does the following thing, controlled knot and then a Hadamard. And then she measures both qubits. So the point of this is actually a measurement in the Bell basis. And then based on this, she's going to get two classical bits that she sends to Bob. And then Bob has to do something, and he's going to get back the original state psi. So let's figure out what this something is and show that we actually do get back psi. So this was time 0. This is going to be time 1. This will be time 2. And then this will be time 3. Okay? So let's just follow the evolution of this circuit over time and see what happens. So at t equals 0, we start with, so let's write psi as alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay, and that's the thing we start with and the thing we want to get. So we start with alpha 0 I plus beta 1 I tensor. This EPR pair, 0A, 0B, plus 1A, 1B. Okay? And then after time 0, before time 1, Alice does a controlled knot from I to A. So at t equals 1, we have the state. Well, there's the zero branch where Alice basically does nothing. So we get 0A, 0B, plus 1A, 1B. And then the one branch. And in the one branch, the A bit has been flipped. So we have 1A, 0B, plus 0A, 1B. Okay? And then at time 2, Alice has done the Hadamard on this I qubit. So what do we have now? So at this point, I think I want to expand out this product and just write everything as a big sum. So, it's going to be a little easier to see what's going on if I keep the normalization here all along. So I'm going to do that. Put in 1 over square root of 2 here. And 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. And so the Hadamard also has a 1 over root 2. So we're going to get an overall 1 half. And so then 0 becomes 0 plus 1. Right? So we have, first we have alpha 0 I 0 A 0 B. Then alpha 1 I 0 A 0 B. And then we have this term, right? Alpha 0 I 1 A 1 B plus alpha 1 I 1 A 1 B. Sorry, there's some lines still visible here. Okay. And so that's this first line we've expanded out. And then the second line. So we have beta. So 1 becomes 0 minus 1. So we also have a 0 here. And then we have 1a, 0b. But then it's minus beta 1 I 1a, 0b. And then finally, it's this term with the 1. So we get plus beta 0 I 0 A 1 B, and then minus beta 1 I 0 A 1 B. OK. So a lot of terms here. But things are about to get simpler. Because the next thing we want to do is we want to measure. And we measure the qubits I and A. So there's 4 possible outcomes. And that we can report it t equals 3. The first outcome is 0, 0 for I and for A. So let's see. So what we can do is we can look through this list for the things that have 0, 0 for I and A. And let me label those with a dot. And down here. OK, there's 2 of them. And so what we get is we get 1 half alpha 0 for B plus beta 1 B. Right? That's what you get by looking at the residual thing for B in these two terms. Okay? So what that means is that with probability, what's the norm of this? Well, alpha squared plus beta squared was 1 because the original state was normalized. So the overall norm of this is 1 half, and so the probability is 1 quarter. So with probability 1 quarter, we get this 0, 0 outcome. And then the residual state is alpha 0 plus beta 1, which is exactly psi. Okay? So when we get the 0, 0 outcome, Bob doesn't have to do anything. He has exactly the state he was supposed to get. OK? When we get the 0, 1 outcome, well, let's label those with, what did I label them with? Circles. 0, 1. So here's 1, 0, 1. Here's the other 0, 1. And so if we look at this, we see that the residual state is alpha 1 plus beta 0. And this is not psi, but it's very closely related to psi. It's just a bit flip times psi. So the bit flip is the NOT gate, but here I'm writing it x for sigma x, the one of the Pauli matrices. Okay? So that's good. So if Alice gets the outcome 0, 1 and she sends that to Bob, Bob knows that in order to get back to the state psi, all he has to do is apply x again. Okay? So that's something he can do. So that's what goes in this box here when Alice sends 0, 1. And this also happens with probability 1 quarter. And 1, 0, well, what about that? So here we have a 1, 0. And here we have another 1, 0. Notice there's a minus sign here. So in this case, we have alpha 0 minus beta 1. Okay? But again, that's not psi, but it's, again, easily related to psi, this time by applying a z. So z is a phase flip. It's a special case of that r theta gate. It's actually r pi over 2 up to a global phase. Okay? So again, if Bob gets this outcome, 1, 0, he knows what to do to get back to psi. He just does z again, flip the phase back. And this also happens with probability 1 quarter. And so then the final result, 1, 1, that should be the remaining terms here. So in that case, we get alpha 1 minus beta 0. So in this case, we have both a bit and a phase flip. So I'm going to write this, again, in terms of a Pauli matrix, as minus I y psi. And so y is equal to 0 minus I 0. Okay? And again, this happens with probability 1 quarter. Okay? So Alice's measurement results are actually completely random, right? It's equally probable that she gets 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. So all she's sending to Bob are random bits, and plus they have this shared EPR pair. But somehow the combination of these two things, which by themselves don't have any information, lets Bob exactly reconstruct the initial state. Even though it's a quantum state that, in principle requires infinitely many bits of information to get, every digit of precision in the amplitudes. So it's kind of remarkable combination of quantum effects that makes this possible. Yes, so this combination of controlled knot, Hadamard, and then measurements, that's all about this. So these individual measurements that I'm writing down in the circuit are just standard basis measurements. Yeah? It has. It's been implemented in a couple of different systems. There have been a number of implementations using light, which is kind of, in some sense, it's a little silly because, you can just send the photon from Alice to Bob. Actually, that's relatively straightforward, so long as they're not too far apart. But in another sense, it's kind of a natural medium to do communications at all. It's easy to, it's a nice medium to set up the EPR pair. So the problem is you need some way that Alice and Bob can communicate quantumly in order to get this entangled state in the first place. Okay? And if they're far apart, that's not so straightforward to arrange. But the thing is that state doesn't have to depend on the state you want to send. So you can do that kind of ahead of time. So in any case, the first implementations have been with light. So later this week, you'll explore linear optics in one of the tutorials. And it turns out that using the standard methods of linear optics, it's not really possible to do this full Bell measurement. So most of the implementations of teleportation have kind of cheated. They only looked at some possible outcomes here and then threw away the other cases. There's also been some that used light in a different encoding. Actually, there's a couple of different encodings that people have done. And in that case, they've done the full teleportation. People have done teleportation in NMR, which I guess you heard about some already in Ben Schumacher's class, NMR quantum computers. And so there, the distance of the teleportation is very, very small. It's the length of a molecule. And people have done it now in ion traps as well. So that's a little bit larger, but still not very big. I'm not sure. By now they might have done it over connecting two separate ion traps, but I'm not certain of that. So there's a variety of implementations people have done. Other questions? Yeah. Yes. So actually, I think that is one of the tutorial problems for today. It turns out that if Alice and Bob share an EPR pair to start with, and Alice sends a qubit to Bob, you can actually send two classical bits rather than just one classical bit, even though you're sending only one qubit. But I'll let you figure out how to do that this afternoon. Possibly. Okay. So there's one small catch here, which is that Alice and Bob start with an EPR pair. So this protocol is called superdense coding, where you send two classical bits using one qubit. Alice and Bob start with an EPR pair, but at the end of the protocol, they don't have the EPR pair anymore. Okay. So they're using up this resource, and the same thing happens in teleportation. So first of all, actually, this is an important point to make. Alice's state psi gets destroyed in the process of quantum teleportation. And Bob receives psi, so it's not lost, but Alice doesn't get to keep a copy. And of course, it had to be, right, because of the no-cloning theorem. There's no way she could keep a copy. But the EPR pairs also gets used up in this protocol. So what you need to do is you need to build up a big supply of EPR pairs. The advantage is that the EPR pairs don't depend on the message you want to send, either in teleportation or in superdense coding. So you could spend, overnight when there's not a lot of communication going on, you can build up lots of EPR pairs. And then you can compress your file once you know what file you want. You can cut it down to half size. This requires, of course, also that you have quantum networks that are capable of sending qubits around very conveniently. But maybe someday that will be possible. Other questions? Okay. Let's see. So maybe I can say a little bit more about the context of teleportation. So we're interested in it not just from a purely theoretical point of view, although it's pretty interesting from a purely theoretical point of view, but it also has some useful applications in the field of quantum computation more generally. So I said in the photonic implementations of teleportation, maybe it's a little bit silly because you can just send a photon through a channel. The problem is that when you do that, sometimes the photon gets lost. Okay, it gets absorbed in the optical fiber, or scatters in the atmosphere, or your detector doesn't pick it up, or something like that. If you want to send a really valuable qubit from Alice to Bob, a much better thing to do is to set up an EPR pair, make sure that your EPR pair is really there, and then teleport your qubit. Okay? That way you don't have to subject your qubit to the dangers of sending it through the quantum channel. Okay? You can do the dangerous part on an EPR pair. You know what the EPR pair is supposed to be. If it doesn't get there, you just try again. Okay? Or otherwise do something to it to modify it. So there's other solutions. You can use a quantum error correcting code, but it turns out that actually the teleportation is better in a couple of respects. So that's one big advantage. It's really useful for moving quantum information around when you can't trust your channels. The other thing is that if you have a big quantum computer, but one where you can only do gates between nearest neighbor qubits, right? Well, it may be a lot more convenient, again, to set up an EPR pair from one side of the computer to the other side and then teleport your qubits to where they want to go rather than try to, you know, do some individual gate that will swap this qubit to here and then swap it to here and then swap it to here and then swap it to here and move it all the way step by step to the other side. That could take a long time. Whereas you can set up this EPR pair ahead of time before you need to move the qubit and then very rapidly send it using teleportation. You do need to send classical communication, but you can do that using a regular classical wire. Okay? So another application of teleportation is that these teleportation-like ideas and actually things that can be built out of teleportation are useful for doing lots of other stuff. So for instance, there's ways of doing quantum gates that are built from teleportation, where basically you take, instead of this standard EPR state, you take some different entangled state, and then you do a measurement here, and you, what you get out is not psi, but you get psi with some gate done on it. Okay? So this doesn't eliminate the difficulty, because you have to create this other entangled state, but it does break it down into smaller parts that can be easier. And I mean, in fact, there's whole models of computation. I should say there are implementations which are basically heavily dependent on doing some form of this. And so teleportation there is kind of a crucial building block, not just for quantum communications, but for quantum computation more generally. Okay. So are there questions on quantum teleportation? Yeah. Right.
That kind of is an inherently non-local way of doing computation?
Well, okay. So it can be non-local, but it doesn't have to be non-local. And the reason is, I phrased regular teleportation as Alice is sending something to Bob, and Alice and Bob are implicitly far apart. But there's no real need to do that, right? So like in the case of the teleportation using NMR, Alice and Bob were actually just on opposite ends of a molecule, right? So they're really, really, really very close together. They're basically in the same computer. And so if you want, you can put these two qubits in the EPR pair just right next to each other. That means it's not useful anymore for communication because they're so close. But for computation, that's fine. You don't care about that. So if you want to do a gate, that's presumably what you're going to do. OK? Other questions? OK, so since I have a few minutes left, why don't I say a little bit about, so far, when I've described unitaries, I mean, when I've described quantum gates, I've always said that they're a unitary gate. But we do, of course, have some things that we do that are not unitary, which is measurements. So let me just say a little bit more about general completely positive maps and how they fit into this picture of quantum gates. I hope you remember completely positive maps from Ben Schumacher's quantum mechanics course. I don't really have time to go into that in any detail, but I think it is worth saying a few words how they interact with the quantum gates. Let's see, where should I draw this? Okay, this is not very interesting anymore. Okay, so the key point is that I don't know if Ben mentioned this, but it's if not, it's certainly a very important point to make. So if we have any completely positive map this is the most general thing that you can do with a quantum operation, right? Completely positive, so that it stays positive on entangled states, and trace preserving, so that you know the total probability of something happening is 1. E can be purified. as follows. So so in a circuit-like notation, we might write E as some big box that takes some number of input qubits and takes some number and gives some number of output qubits. And these don't have to be the same, right? Because it's a completely positive map. So for instance, a map that that just throws away one qubit is perfectly fine. Okay, that's a legal operation. As is a map that adds qubits, right? It just adds an extra ancilla qubit in the state zero. That's allowed. And in any case, those things are actually basically all you can do, those two plus unitary. So we can write this as something of this form, where we have our inputs, we have some extra ancilla qubits, which we can, without loss of generality, assume are in the state zero. And then we do some unitary. And then any extra qubits that we don't need, we throw away. So trash can. Okay? And this is the most general completely positive map can be written in this form. So did he do this? No. Okay.
He did purification, just the usual
purification. Of density matrices. I see. Okay. So so it turns out that arbitrary completely positive maps can be purified as well. And that kind of goes with the purification of density matrices. It works more or less the same way. Okay. So this is a really important property. And this means that if we can do any unitary, well, then we can also do any completely positive map. Okay? Because all we need to do in addition to the unitaries is add ancillas and throw away qubits. Okay, so in that case, I should probably mention this, the similar thing for POVMs. So suppose you have a POVM, okay? It turns out that this can also be implemented using unitaries, extra ancilla qubits, and standard basis measurements. So again, we bring in some ancillas, we do some unitary, and then we measure. And we may not need all of these individual outcomes, so we might just want to bunch them up into the different possible outcomes E1, E2, E3, et cetera. Okay, so there might be some additional classical post-processing that divides these up. Okay? But again, it's something that if you can do an arbitrary unitary and, you know, add ancillas and measure, you can do an arbitrary POVM. Okay? So when I was calling this universal, even though we only had unitary gates and measurements, it really is universal. These are the most general things allowed by quantum mechanics, and we can still do them using our same set of gates. Yeah. Yeah, okay, this may be not a good phrase here, but yeah, so that's the point, is that I'm implementing it basically using projective measurements. And in fact, measurements just in one standard basis.
Is it
a Neumark? Yeah, maybe. I never remember the names of these things. But it is. Okay. Okay? So that's probably enough for today. Then, again, you can ask questions on this stuff tomorrow, or really later than that if you want. There's no time limit. But tomorrow, I'd like to get started on implementations. So we'll talk about, I threw off the names of some things answering questions, but we'll get to see, tomorrow we'll probably see how ion traps work. And then Thursday, I'll kind of give you an overview of some of the other implementations. Okay.